Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we are excited to release the first of many episodes recorded live during our American Writers Festival on May 15th, 2022, which featured more than 75 leading writers from across the country. In this episode, writer Vincent Tirado discusses their young adult novel Burn Down, Rise Up with journalist Andrew Davis. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome to this program of the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am a program coordinator here at the American Writers Museum. I'm here to introduce to you our guest for our next event today. In Burn Down, Rise Up, author Vincent Tirado takes urban legends, mysterious disappearances, and brave young people determined to save their city and creates an urban horror novel that comments on gentrification and systematic racism. Number one, New York Times bestselling author Mariki Mazur-Kamp calls it a breathtaking, read-it-all-in-one-sitting thrill of a novel. Vincent Tirado is a non-binary Afro-Latine born in the Bronx. A lover of all things horror and sci-fi, they've been published in Fire Magazine and Desert Rose Lit Mag. They've also been known to write for podcasts with credits in Nemozine and Cry Havoc. In their free time, Vincent spends time with their cat and sews their own cosplay for Comic-Con. To lead the discussion, we welcome back Andrew Davis, executive editor of the Chicago-based LGBTQ+ media outlet Windy City Times. Please join me in welcoming Vincent and Andrew.
Thank you. Ready?
Yep. Not convincing
you
at all.
You sound so ready. Tell him. Okay, so you and I have something in common.
Is it our good looks?
Well, okay, we have two things in common. No, besides that, we actually both majored in biology.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and it paid off in dividends, you can see.
Clearly.
So, I'm curious as to how you made the transition from biology to journalism, but I know you also work with computers, so.
Mm-hmm. Went to school for biology, and then I got my master's in bioethics because I wanted to get into medicine, like so many children of immigrants do. It was something that like my entire family was like, you know, like kind of gunning for me. I also really did enjoy science, so it wasn't like, oh, I had no like real love of the craft, but I was genuinely into it. But I also developed anxiety from studying and tests, and just did not work out for me the way that unfortunately my family wanted it to. I was always writing, like as a kid, I've always been a big writer. Whenever I got sick of studying, I would be writing short stories, or I'd be outlining like, oh, here's a fun novel I'd like to write one day. And so writing has always been something that kind of followed me since I was young. Medicine didn't quite work out for me, I was like, okay, I guess I'm just gonna take the plunge into writing then, and that's what happened.
And the parents were thrilled?
Well, they're proud that something good came of this.
Okay, let's jump into the book, which I'm telling you, if you haven't read it, it is so, so good. I mean, it just drew me in. Because at first I'm like, 300 plus pages, are you kidding me?
I thought that was short, actually.
Well, yeah. I guess that's true. You mean like compared to War and Peace, or?
I don't know. Like, I always think that like a good novel has to be like 400 pages, maybe 450, I don't know. Somewhere around that.
Well, I read the whole thing in no time flat. So, kudos to you.
Thank you.
If you can get me to do that, that's saying something. But tell me about the title. We're going to start with this. Burn Down, Rise Up. Tell us what that is about.
So when I originally wrote this, it had a different title altogether. It was called The Next Stop Is, because the whole novel is kind of like centered on like the subway train system in New York. And so anytime you get on a train and you hear the doors close, the first thing you hear is The Next Stop Is. Unfortunately, my publisher didn't think that the title was eye-catching, and so we played around with a lot of different titles that really spoke true to the novel, and we came up with Burn Down, Rise Up.
Oh, so it was a joint effort.
I mean, I'm happy with it. So they came up with it and I said, sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, let's also dive into this plot, which is so, it's very layered.
Mm-hmm.
It's literal and it's metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
There are elements of fiction and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't even know where to start with this. I know where I'll start. The element of same-sex romance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask you something I asked Archie during the 1 o'clock session, which is with the book bans that are going on around the country,
right.
How concerned are you that this might be banned in some areas?
I think I'd be like really upset, I think. And I am like concerned to an extent, but even like, let's say I decided to straight wash this, like I just mm-hmm. made like every character straight. I think it would still be in danger of like being banned because it does touch into the layers of systemic racism and like such, like I couldn't write the book without including that, you know? So it's just like, even if I straight washed it, it would still like, there will be some parents who are like, they're trying to indoctrinate our children into like critical race theory. I'm like,
I was just about to say,
yeah, like it's just like, oh, you know, it's a black character. Like you're like, someone's going to be upset about it. I don't know. It's, so like, even if I wanted to like, you know, reach as many people as possible, if it's not going to be one thing, it's going to be another thing. There's no way for me to like, unless I wrote a completely different novel, like I genuinely could not write this book without introducing the idea or at least like speaking on systemic racism and the effects of it. It genuinely does upset me to know that that might happen. Because I'm someone who, I kind of grew up not having a lot. I was generally a very poor kid, but the one thing I always did have was libraries. And so I would go out to the library every Saturday with my best friend, who now works as an assistant editor at Penguin Random House. So now we're both in publishing. We would go out every Saturday and like pick out a stack of books to read. And so now when I think of like who will be affected by like these book bannings, it's going to be kids like me who didn't have much anyways. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, you did. There's also a character, what I call it, a character, in addition to, you know, Raquel, Charlize. By the way, Charlize is after Charlize Theron, or just
that was no? I just named her that.
Like, oh, okay.
Happy just coincidence, though.
Happy coincidence.
Yeah.
But the character I'm thinking of is the Bronx itself,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you included or wrote about the Bronx because it's what you know. Is it a love letter to the Bronx? Tell me about that process that led you to make the Bronx so prominent.
When I started to like write about like this idea, so the whole idea kind of came after I was I had finished Stranger Things, and I really liked how in Stranger Things they introduce an element of like history within like all these layers of like compelling characters and so on. So like in Stranger Things, the main like little nugget of history is MK Ultra and like how that had affected families. And of course, like, you know, they introduce things like, oh, now there's monsters and there's this other dimension. And so when I was like thinking about like, okay, I want to write something like that, like I want to have an upside down of sorts, it only like kind of clicked in that it could only be the Bronx. It was the only place I ever lived. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like too hard to be like, okay, like what place should I base this on? What point of history should this be about? It, for me, it was just like, oh yeah, my hometown. That's it.
And one inescapable element that you certainly include in there is racism, systemic racism. One of the things I think people are going to find surprising, and it's only something I learned about recently, is about how racist infrastructure is, bridges, and well, the bridges aren't racist, but the people who designed them are.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit about that, like about Robert Moses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when I was in high school, I had this after school program at a community development center. It was like mentioned in the book, the mm-hmm. Point CDC. And the after school program was called Activists Coming to Inform Our Neighborhood. Otherwise, just the acronym was ACTION. And so it was just a group of teens who were like kind of like learning about the history of the Bronx, like our neighborhood, learning about what issues are kind of affecting us and how we can go about and enacting change in our neighborhood. And so one of the things we stumbled upon was just the fact that there were like, you know, legislation that kind of like kind of soaked in the like racism in like very insidious ways, because I think one of the worst kinds of racism is when you don't notice it. Like, you don't notice that it's all around you. You don't notice when it's in like every brick of your apartment. And so when I was a teenager and I was learning about Robert Moses and the way he decided, okay, here's how we're gonna structure this whole neighborhood, it was obvious that it came with the intent to disadvantage us at every way possible. Because, I mean, one of the things that I was mentioned in the book was making the cross Bronx, or making one of the expressways so low so that buses couldn't pass through, which would like effectively kind of, I want to say like segregate the neighborhood, like, yeah, like kind of like, you know, yeah, like segregate the neighborhood, because like who's going to have the money to buy a car, especially in New York. People are known for like just taking like the subway or the bus, but if the buses can't go anywhere because, oh, this is too low, it won't pass through, then like now you're stopping people from getting into other parts of their home. And so that was like something that I don't think a lot of people do realize when it comes to racism. A lot of it is The initial thought is mostly about like Klansmen and like white hoods and things like that, but they don't think about the people in charge who can, you know, like be the ones in charge of building your own apartment or building your home, building like all of these like just structures around you, and then like what can you do about it?
And something that I also talked a little bit when I was talking with Archie was about representation, because you want to see yourself being included. I pointed out to someone the other day that if you don't see yourself somewhere, maybe, especially for kids who are definitely more impressionable, maybe someone will think, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be included. So could you talk about how important representation is to you personally, and also how important it is in this book?
It was very, I mean, It would not make sense if, like, in this book, like, all the characters were white. Like, if you go into the Bronx, that's definitely not, like, the racial makeup of the Bronx. So it wasn't just about, like, oh, representation. It was about keeping it accurate to, like, the reality of it. And so, like, I mean, I rant about this with my friends about, like, when In the Heights came out. And I was just like, that's not what Washington Heights looks like. Like, he got it all wrong. We got to fight these people. And it was just like, oh, you know, a lot of people were saying, it's representation. I'm like, it's not accurate. That's not actually how real life works. And so, like, you know, when it goes back to kids being like, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to be included. If they don't see themselves in their own home, then what message are you trying to send to them?
Yes. Also, there are elements of religion that are discussed. What's that look for?
Okay, so my mother is a very like hardcore Christian. I actually don't know many people who do practice Santeria or Brujeria. I mean, I have like some friends who like dabble here and there, some who like, you know, tarot cards, things like that. But I was always like, growing up, I was not allowed to go into those places. It just was not supposed to be like something I could dabble into. But I did recognize that there's a lot of Brujerias like around the Bronx. Like any other like block, there could be just one like kind of squared away in a corner. And so when I was writing this book, again, with like keeping what's accurate, I didn't want to be like, oh, you know, Christianity is all there is, because in our culture, there's like multiple ways or like multiple beliefs that felt were very integral to our character.
Something I noticed, and earlier I talked about the whole metaphorical aspect. When the characters are in your upside down, quote unquote, they're battling a slumlord. Now, I assume that's supposed to stand for a metaphor itself in terms of, or not?
Both, I guess. It's metaphorical in the fact that, like, like, along with the fact that, okay, Robert Moses built these places, but, like, who's the one in charge of the buildings? Who's the ones that are supposed to make sure that there's adequate heating? But, you know, sometimes in winters, you're just, you're layering up inside your own bed. I've had, like, a number of times in my childhood where, like, the living situation, like, yeah, we had a home. We weren't homeless, but it was effectively just not adequate housing. And, like, it's, if you don't have, like, a lot to your name, if you don't, like, you can't take these landlords to the court, essentially. Like, it's very difficult to make sure that you can get what you need out of a housing situation. And so with the slumlord, that's kind of a thing that is a constant issue, not just in the Bronx, but, like, in so many housing situations across America. There are just always people who have more power than you because, you know, they own your home or, like, they have more pull with what happens. And so when I, you know, I had them, like, battle them, I was just kind of thinking about all those situations in my life where it's just like, why is there no heating in the dead of winter? Like, what is going on here? We should have heating. And then, like, another thing I wish I had touched more upon was just about, like, accessibility in a lot of these homes. So, like, my first home I ever lived in, like, there were six floors, no elevator. So, like, for someone who's disabled, how are they even supposed to go up and come down? So it was, like, there's a lot of things that are wrong with housing that don't really get touched upon, especially, like, in poor neighborhoods.
There's a lot that's wrong, but there are also elements that are right, correct? Mm-hmm. There's an element of hope in this book. Could you talk about the brighter side? Because I think one of the things you discuss in this book is that people have this stereotypical view of the Bronx when there are all of these other aspects that are quite hopeful.
Yeah, so, you know, like, housing was not great growing up, but when I went to a high school and I started going to Action, I kind of, like, discovered that hope. Because, like, from the time I was a kid to up until high school, I was kind of like, well, you know, if I don't like how it is in the Bronx, I just gotta leave. But then when I was, like, at, you know, Action, when I was at the Point, someone actually gave me this new idea, which was, you don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. And so what it kind of signaled to me was just like, okay, there is an opportunity for change. There is, like, an opportunity to make things better. But we probably just can't rely on the same systems to eventually realize that we're humans and we, like, have, you know, rights. We have to find those opportunities of change in each other. We have to reach out to our neighbors, our residents. And effectively, like, having a lot of like, mutual aid and community outreach and organizing was one of the most powerful ways that I discovered that, okay, like, I can make my neighborhood more livable in a sense.
Mm-hmm. In essence, not abandoning your neighborhood, but sticking with it and working to make it better.
Right.
Yeah. I totally get that. I am wondering what you would like people to take away from this book.
I guess, like, just what I said about community organizing. I think a lot of, especially now, there's always this push that, oh, we need to, you know, vote blue and we need to vote, you know, this person into power. And it's just like, okay, what happens afterwards, though? What happens when they don't do what they said they were going to do? You need to have a contingency plan. You know, you need to make sure that you follow up on these things. So one of the things I hope people take away from this is that, like, voting is all good and well, but community organizing is something you need to have in effect at all stages of, like, any sort of change you're trying to enact.
And what do you think this book says about you?
That's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. Hold on, I gotta think now. Mm-hmm. Jesus, okay.
I haven't even asked you the really good one yet.
Are you sure? Because that one's real. Okay. So I would say this book probably says that I do have a real love for my neighborhood. So, like, I no longer live in the Bronx. I moved out to Pennsylvania for very specific reasons. It wasn't to abandon it. I needed to get out there for other reasons. But I hope that, like, when people read it, that they know that they not only they see themselves, but they see that I am like their neighbor, that I like grew up there, that I know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the point or like specific avenues or like how the trains run. So I hope that people recognize the authenticity of this book.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, with me being a horror movie fan,
okay,
you know I appreciate that element of the book, but not everyone is, so
right.
How would you advise them to approach the gore? Not that there's a ton, but there are certain moments you...
So I had actually toned down the gore of the book. So I'm a massive horror movie fan. Like
to me too. What's like, your favorite?
Oh, I'm gonna say Stay Alive. It's an old one from 2006. Yeah, it's definitely like good for its time. It would not work as well now. But
has anyone heard of Stay Alive? No.
It had Frankie Muniz in it, which is very weird. But listen, it works though.
Moving right along.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I toned it down a lot, and I'm the kind of person that like does a yearly Saw movie marathon. Like I will watch like all of the movies in order from start to finish.
Nice.
It's definitely, you know, very, it's like 12 hours, something like 12
yeah,
hours
so
of like,
a lot.
Yeah. So, like my agent had to be like, we should probably like remove this. We can tone this down. And I'd be like, but it's not as good. And like, I mean, she was right, because even now I still have people being like, oh, this was really scary. And I was like, really? I thought I toned it down a lot. No. I guess for, like, in terms of gore, I think if you're someone who cannot take descriptions that are, like, you know, like zombie-like behavior or, like, just so, like, I don't know, if you can't watch zombie movies because, you know, they're always caked in blood and things like that, their skin is ripped apart, this will probably be very difficult for you to get through. I definitely would not read it while eating is another way I would describe it.
Okay.
Yep.
Sorry,
or cooking, actually.
Or
so
cooking.
If any, like, smoke in the air, you probably want to wait until, because this does have a lot of imagery about like fire and burning.
Yeah.
So you probably want to wait after you're finished with the meal, you've digested enough of it that it won't come back up. Yeah.
Okay. Wow, I went down that road and yeah,
yep.
Didn't I? Yeah, that's on me. So I said I had a better question. I don't know if it's a better question, but it's a general question. It's
okay.
Something I've asked a variety of people. You know, I've asked Billie Jean King, I've talked with Dr. Fauci, asked them this question. But over the past couple of years,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've had to deal, obviously, with the pandemic, we've dealt with some people having a racial awakening.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about yourself?
Like in writing this book?
No, not necessarily in writing, just in general.
Oh.
Life.
I guess I've learned that I'm a lot more resilient than I thought I was. I definitely did not think I would make it to this age when I was a kid. And for some reason, like as a kid, I couldn't like envision myself living beyond 18. And then I get to 18 and I was like, well, I definitely won't live beyond graduation of like college. And then I made it then and I was just like, oh Jesus, I need to have an actual plan for what I'm doing with my life. And so
yeah,
now that I'm just like, yeah, I'm pretty resilient. I should probably like think about how I want my life to go from this moment on.
So, regarding the book, what would you say was the most difficult part of it, and what was the easiest part of it?
I'm gonna go in the reverse. The easiest
okay.
part is like more of the descriptions of the places, because these are places I've been to, you know, grown up and went to high school at Hyatt High School, went to the Point for after school. Like a lot of the descriptions, I didn't have to think too hard in it.
Okay.
The most difficult part was, and this is like because my editor like was just like, listen, this is gonna suck, but you have to get like, you need to nail down the research on this. So if you read any statistics in here, I had to painstakingly go out and find research that backed it up. Because like it's one thing for me to be like, oh yeah, I think it's around like that. And she's just like, no. If you're gonna have statistics, you need to make sure that it's correct. And so the research that I had to do for this book, which involved like usually either talking with people that lived through the decade of fire, or literally watching a documentary, and I like had to take notes and everything. So that was like one of the most difficult parts of this book.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, as a journalist, I definitely know you have to have items to back it up. And yeah, having gone to law school, evidence.
It was rough.
But you did it. Yeah. That's the important thing. I was going to also ask about if you were thinking of a sequel.
For this book?
Mm-hmm. Or no, do you feel like you've...
I could do it. I could definitely do a sequel. Probably not from Raquel or Charlize's point of view. I would like to tackle a sequel from like Aaron's point of view.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, he's such a goofy kid who like, he definitely means well.
Oh, you might want to, I don't know if you want to describe Aaron.
Okay. So Aaron is Raquel's best friend, and they end up in sort of a like love triangle together because Raquel and Aaron both like this other girl, Charlize. I won't give a spoiler on who she ends up with, but it's not Aaron. and so, like, I think that, and like, also he has like a situation, like he has an older brother that he like sort of get along with. It's mm-hmm. it's like it's fine, like it's okay. So I feel like kind of like getting into the mindset of a teenage boy who is just rejected and like now like knows that there is an upside down and stuff, like I think it would be like a very interesting thing to kind of like parse through.
Do you think this is something, and again I guess this would apply to the sequel if there is a sequel, that could actually move to another city, say Chicago or LA? Like, you would have to do the research. I know how much you love research. But is that something you could see, or?
I would have to spend time in that city to like really nail it down.
Just set it in Pennsylvania then, I guess.
I guess, sort of.
What's the one thing you want people to take away about the Bronx?
That it definitely is packed with its own culture and its own vibe, and like, and as cool as it is, like, it's really the people that make it what it is. So I mean, like with the effects of like gentrification and like people moving out or and others moving in, the people who kind of make it, like bring a lot of the culture to the neighborhood, like they're the ones that really make it just the Bronx. If like everyone left and like new people like moved in, it wouldn't be the same Bronx as the one that I know.
And my last question, mm-hmm. also something I asked earlier, you know, Pride Month is around the corner. Mm-hmm. What does Pride mean to you?
Pride to me, I guess it just means not having to be afraid and second guessing yourself all the time. It's just something that like you, it's not stuck in the back of your head. You can just kind of like move through life without having to like really dwell on it in like, you know, instances of just like, oh, how do other people like view me? Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, if I tell them about like who my partner is, how are they gonna react to that?
And are you fine doing that now? Or do you have moments of hesitation?
Oh, I definitely have moments of hesitation. Life is a series of coming out. Like that is how it is currently. Which, you know, sometimes you just have to either grin and bear it, or you decide, you know what, this place isn't for me. I'm going to go somewhere else where I feel a little bit safer.
So I know whenever you work on something, you look back, and I think you're a perfectionist like I am. Is there anything you would like to rework if you had a chance to rewrite this?
If I had a chance to rewrite this.
You did mention one thing about the Bronx, but I was wondering if there was anything else.
Yeah, I think, I really can't think. Like, I know there's probably something, but right now it's just like, I'm drawing blanks right
now.
So
this is perfect.
It's great for right now. Come back to me in 3 months.
It's pretty good.
I'm going to wake up in a cold sweat. Like, I should have changed that one thing.
Don't call me at 3 a.m. I'm going to pretend you don't exist.
I would like to ask a question. I feel like a question that we get a lot from visitors or especially students when they come and is asking advice on how can you write? And so that's a question that I'd pose to you, is that if someone came up to you and said, give me one piece of advice for helping me to take that first step into writing a novel, what would your advice be?
I guess I would say start small. And I mean that in, if like, let's say, okay, I want to write a novel, I'd be like, all right, what are the most important pieces of like the storytelling for you? Is it like, okay, here are the characters, what are they like? What are you trying to do from point A to point B of like the novel? Just like getting down those small details like really does help a lot in kind of pushing you forward to like, okay, so if I know we're starting from here and I know I want to get to here and I know I have this host of characters, what happens in the middle?
Awesome, thank you. Yeah. Thank you all to our program participants for being here today and for all of you for allowing us to celebrate American writing safely and in person. And if you all can join me in thanking once again, Vincent and Andrew.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, writer Archie Bongiovanni discusses their graphic novel, The Stonewall Riots, Making a Stand for LGBTQ Rights, a history comics book. Archie is joined by journalist Andrew Davis, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.